Just as Alaska is a large geographic area with diverse climates and inhabitants, a marginal road network, and a mélange of educational delivery systems to the bush, so is Australia. Frank Darnell, former director of the Center for Northern Educational Research at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, spent 6 weeks in Australia recently, flying in to remote bush locations, visiting schools. Most of his time was spent in Western Australia, the Northern Territory, and Southern Australia. The administration of the school systems Darnell visited differed considerably from Alaska, which is decentralized and favors local control.
Essentially, Australian schools are centrally administered by a chief school administrator, in the case of Western Australia, called the Director General of Education, who maintains a large central staff and directs the operation of schools regardless of the distance, regardless of the remoteness or their degree of ruralness or urbanness.
One small step toward decentralization has been taken recently in Western Australia, an area Darnell says is quite similar to Alaska. There, several district superintendencies have been created to oversee the 1 million square miles, an area almost twice the size of Alaska.
But these districts don't have any boards, they don't have any autonomy, nor do they have any real authority over the selection of teachers or the programs that are developed.
There is also no control over the curriculum, no local variations.
It's a uniform curriculum wherever one goes, be it in the heart of Perth or a small Aboriginal village on the north coast or a large sheep station in the center of the desert.
However, there is one area where local people have influenced education.
There are a great many one-room schools, and while a few years ago there was a movement to consolidate them, especially in the areas where there are reasonable road networks, this trend has been reversed primarily because of the objection of local people who value the small one- and two-room schools over larger urban areas or over the long distances that children are being bused.
There are always arguments of trade-offs in the quality of education when children are kept in isolated one-room schools rather than having access to larger, more modern facilities, an argument often heard in Alaska as well. But where Alaskan experiments in so-called distance education have been sporadic and experimental, Australia has been a pioneer.
Well, of course, Australia initiated the idea of radio-assisted instruction, and to this day carries out a vast network along this line. However, there are limitations to it that only now are the Australians coming to recognize and to correct. When the system was initiated a good 20 years or more ago, it was following on the shirt tails of the medical system. There's a very extensive what's called Royal Doctor Flying Service, and where radios are located on sheep and cattle stations and small settlements to call the services of physicians when needed. During off times on medical calls, the schools started using the same frequencies and in some cases the same equipment. So that the present radio school of the air, while it started along that line, is now an independent branch of the school service, but it still uses the same frequencies and in many cases antiquated equipment. In one area of Australia, the interference is so severe from thunderstorms that the radio can only be used approximately 40% of the time. And thus, while the notion is quite sound and it has been successful, the technical limitations at the moment are frustrating the teachers far more than the pedagogical ones.
This technically imperfect application of radio-assisted instruction is only for the primary grades. At about the age of 12, parents and child must make a decision. Those parents who can afford to send their children to boarding schools in larger communities do so, and those who cannot will continue their child's education through correspondence, a situation Darnell terms unsatisfactory, and a situation not much different from that in Alaska until fairly recently, when the state-operated school system was abandoned in favor of rural education attendance areas and increased local control.
One of the errands I was on while in Australia was to attend the National Conference on Rural Education at Perth. And if anything of substance came from the conference that's apt to have a lasting effect, it was the clear message from rural residents that they expect decentralization. Ultimately, not in the sense that we would hear, but you have to keep it in terms of the Australian situation at the moment, where it is highly centralized. You don't automatically jump into an American school district system. As a matter of fact, I would expect that probably won't ever come about in our time. But what can be expected is district superintendents, regionalization to take place, where there will be a great deal more community input and a great deal of effort to relate the community situation to the programs in the school. And the parents clearly were speaking to this need.
Now, at a time when at least one Alaskan school district, Northwest Arctic, is working to minimize or eliminate local parent input into the school system, rural Alaskans are working on their school administrators to increase their say. One wonders if parents do achieve inroads toward local control, if that term will mean bureaucratic control of the locals or local control of the bureaucrats and of the school system that is meant to educate their children. You've been listening to Dr. Frank Darnell, Professor Emeritus at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. In 1973, the state legislature passed legislation that required both a permit and a license for people engaged in commercial fishing, and established the Alaska Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission to control and limit the number of people who fished commercially. Many people who applied for permits did not receive them, or instead got only temporary permits, and many people did not understand the regulation requiring that they obtain both a commercial license and a permit. Which applicants actually received a permit was determined by a number of factors, including evidence of previous sales of fish or salmon roe and the degree of economic dependence on commercial fishing. The Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission awarded points for evidence of years of sales, and many people had no documentation. That and the confusion over permit and license continues to create what some see as an inequitable situation in some of the state's fisheries, particularly the Upper Yukon freshwater salmon fishery. Senator John Sackett of Galena was in Nulato recently to conduct a meeting on limited entry regulations. With him were John Williams, a commissioner with the Commercial Fisheries Commission, and Douglas Pope, principal author of a study of the Upper Yukon fishery. Sackett explained how he got involved in the limited entry issue.
I had a lot of people come to me and say, I fished all these years, I didn't have a chance to apply, or even when I applied, they didn't give me enough points, so that in the end, I finally lost out. And a lot of people, even today, don't know whether or not they will ever have enough points. And every time I come through the villages, people ask me to investigate their particular one.
In February of this year, Sackett introduced a bill, sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 187, that he hopes will reopen the applications, enabling more people in the Upper Yukon salmon fishery to obtain commercial permits.
To see if we could try and include in some way a lot of people who felt that they had been left out, who didn't have a chance to apply, and who, for a number of different reasons, didn't get enough points. And so that's this one, that's the Senate Bill 187. At the same time, Representative Nels Anderson from Dillingham introduced this other bill called House Bill 665 in the House, which opened up, as late applicants, it opened it up entirely for late applicants to file.
The Anderson bill, unlike Sackett's, has statewide application and would not significantly affect the Upper Yukon fishery. Two areas have been studied for potential impact, the Kuskokwim and Bristol Bay drift net fisheries. According to Fred Anderson, a fisheries biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, the number of permits in the Kuskokwim would increase, though by what number is unknown. But in Bristol Bay, at least 500 additional fishers would qualify, a figure disputed by Alaska Legal Services lawyers in Dillingham, who claim the figure is an overestimation. Overestimation or not, the United Fishermen's Association fears that passage of Anderson's bill would flood the fisheries with new permits, resulting in increased pressure, more restrictions, and less money for each person fishing. In the Upper Yukon, target for Sackett's bill, the situation is not as acute. There, the distinction between subsistence and commercial fishing is not so well defined. Markets for fish have been irregular, and selling fish has, in the past, been a supplement to the primary activity of harvesting salmon for personal use. That picture has changed in the past few years, due in part to the permit requirement and to the financial incentive. Now, subsistence fishing has declined, along with the dog teams that fed on the bales of dried chums and the piles of salmon strips formerly brought to potlatches. More people want permits to get a piece of the commercial market. But many people who now want to enter the fishery did not have a commercial license in 1974 and 75, the years used by the commission to determine eligibility for a permit. And now to get a permit, they must purchase it from someone else. Sackett's bill could change that by putting out more permits, estimated by Anchorage lawyer Doug Pope at between 50 and 75. Permit holders present at the Nulato meeting made no verbal comments on the probable consequence of a reduction in revenues, but those holding temporary permits or no permits at all repeatedly stated their support for the idea behind Sackett's bill. Another popular provision of the bill allows for a family permit, wherein all members of a family lacking a permit could pool their points and obtain a non-transferable permit. According to Sackett, the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission has been discriminatory in regard to the Upper Yukon fishery, and for that reason he has singled out this fishery, which includes his hometown of Galena, as a target for Senate Bill 187, a bill that, because it singles out one area for major changes, may run into some opposition. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.
In spring and summer into the fall of 78, a group of Anchorage women found a need for Alaska Native women to get together besides once a year at their annual AFN convention. So they formed a group in Anchorage and passed a resolution at the 1978 convention, AFN convention. So that's when we got started.
As a result of that 1978 meeting, Winnie Atwood, the speaker, became the Fairbanks representative to the Alaska Native Women's statewide organization, but not without some controversy. Controversy that some women associated with the upcoming convention expect will surface. According to one source who asked that she not be identified, the interior delegates to that formative meeting in Anchorage had selected another woman as their representative and reluctantly accepted Atwood only to avoid a confrontation, not only within their group, but with the powerful Anchorage bloc as well. And the hard feelings remain, even as Atwood does the legwork for the meetings of the next few days. In spite of internal struggles, the group is in the process of getting incorporated and is seeking funding. Some Native regional corporations are financing delegates to attend the convention, and according to Atwood, several oil companies have chipped in money as well. Partly as a result of that financial support, more delegates are expected to attend this year's gathering than were able to do so last year.
We had our first convention in Anchorage last year, which 273 women attended.
How many are you expecting this year?
Well, we're expecting over 300 this year.
Letters were sent out to every village informing people of the convention. According to Atwood, 12 women from interior villages are expected, half funded by Tanana Chiefs and the other half through Doyon Limited, and Bethel is sending in 25.
Looking over the agenda for the three-day conference, it seems that it's quite heavily into workshops. How did you decide on that kind of structure?
Last year we had the workshops, and these are some of the things that came out of last year's workshops and some recommendations. We have four board meetings a year, which is for the 13 representatives that sit on the statewide board.
Is that one from each regional corporation?
One from each regional corporation plus one person at large who does the publicity.
Well, but there are 13 regional corporations counting the one outside.
Well, that one wasn't represented.
At times, there are as many as 9 concurrent workshops. The focus for the workshops on Thursday is Alaska Native Heritage, Culture, and You, with sessions on family changes, single mothers, moving to an urban area, changing roles and careers, and motivating support for young Native women. Friday morning's theme is Alaska Native Women, Issues, and Identities, and workshops include promoting Native women onto boards, Native women as traditional and contemporary leaders, and alcoholism education and prevention. That afternoon, there are workshops centering around public policy, Alaska Native women, and our families. The results of all workshops will be compiled and recommendations made on the final day of the gathering, Saturday, May 3rd.
Each day of the convention, one of the workshops, the last one on the list every time, is a special workshop for non-Natives and men. They're the same?
Well, the reason we had that was in there was last year at the convention there was a lot of commotion going on at the workshops because people were coming in like maybe five or six coming in, attending one workshop and dominating one workshop, and it didn't give the people from the village a chance to really say what they wanted to say. So we set aside this workshop for non-natives and men.
She explained that meant non-natives of either sex and native men. What sort of recommendations such a diverse group was expected to come up with was unclear. Another fuzzy area concerns the relationship or lack of relationship with the North American Indian Women's Association.
Is your group affiliated with any national movement toward involving Native women?
No, it's just strictly Alaska. They do have national Native women organizations, but who is going to be our main speaker? Mary Natana.
But there's no affiliation?
No.
Any plans for it?
Well, they do have a chapter in Fairbanks, I understand, but I don't know anything about it.
Is that the group that Mary Jane Fate has been working with?
I think so.
Mary Jane Fate is, in fact, a charter member of the North American Indian Women's Association and a past national president. After our interview, Atwood complained about the lack of information between the national and state organizations and indicated this was a touchy area. Perhaps Mary Natani's keynote address will help to bridge the communication gap and soothe some of the emotions that have interfered with that communication, a non-agenda item that is expected to surface. But establishing a working relationship between the national and statewide Native women's organizations, or easing the conflicts between regional groups and within delegations, is not, says Atwood, the primary purpose for the meeting.
The main thing is we're trying to get our Native women in one place at one time for education. The theme of our convention is understanding our heritage for tomorrow. And if you look into the past, a lot of the Native women in the villages, and even myself, we kind of say, well, this is the way we've been doing it, and it's kind of hard to take a woman that's raised, like myself, 11 children, and try to look ahead maybe 10 years. And this is what we're trying to do, is get education for the Native women. And we feel that being together in a group, that we can come to some kind of conclusion on how we can help each other.
The way things are shaping up before the three-day Alaska Native Women's Organization convention even opens, people may need to help each other. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. One of the issues on the hidden agenda of the three-day Alaska Native Women's statewide convention crept to the surface this morning. That was the matter of affiliating or not affiliating with the National North American Indian Women's Association. Mary Natani, a Winnebago Indian from Wisconsin, the current president of the national organization, was invited to Fairbanks to deliver this morning's keynote address. Wearing a white buckskin garment adorned with loomed and hanging beads, Natani spoke forcefully about herself, her beliefs, and the need for Indian women to work together toward resolving common issues.
Because of the lack of opportunity to develop the kinds of leadership skills that we need, another danger is our thinking too locally. We think in terms of where we are right now. You here in Fairbanks, you think of what's here. The danger of thinking locally is that you get involved in pettiness. You get involved with individualism. Instead of sticking to the issues, we're picking at each other, as if that there's not enough of that from the outside society. We pick at each other because you don't agree with what I have to say, and I don't agree with what you have to say, so I'm not going to talk to you. Rather than focusing our attention to the fact that because of this discrimination that exists, it affects all of us. All of our families are affected, our young people are affected, our elders are affected. I think we have to get away from that kind of a pettiness. We've got to stick with the issues. I've been talking to a number of you since I've been here yesterday. You have the same problems that we face down there. I would really like to encourage you to join us in our organization. We have 14 chapters in the southern 48 states. Our organization is recognized as one of the top three powerful Indian organizations out in Washington. And we're now in a position where we can do something, where we can be heard. And until we all join forces, work together, address some of the common concerns and issues, I think this is one area where we as Native women can make a mark on history.
For the Alaska Native Women's statewide organization, that mark may be, at least for the present, in disappearing ink. Mary Jane Peterson, an Aleut now living in Anchorage, is the group's current president.
We do not want to become affiliated with the North American Indian Women's Association. We are separate in Alaska, and we want to have our own organization. Our board members decided, you know, that we are separate, Alaska is separate, and Native women are separate, and we have not been, you know, tied in with the North American Indian Women's Association.
Mary Natani thinks the tie should be made, though she doesn't intend to force the issue.
I think it's something that they have to decide. But I think that when I was talking about our women being local in their thinking, that's one of the things that I'm talking about, that you've got to be global in your thinking. You can't just think for just right here and right now, because you're never going to solve anything like that. I think the more they think about it and the kind of support that they would realize from becoming affiliated with us, I think that they'll give it more serious thought. They're so remote up here that they need all the support they can get.
Asked what the Alaska Women's Group might be afraid of, given the reluctance to affiliate, Natani responded,
I don't think they're afraid of anything. I think that they have to get their own ducks in line out here.
Tomorrow, the new board for the Alaska Native Women's Organization will be announced, and with those changes, maybe the ducks will line up differently. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. The second day of the second annual Alaska Native Women's Organization convention opened calmly, but within the first half hour, it was clear that, to use Mary Natani's words, the ducks were not yet in line. Natani, president of the North American Indian Women's Association, warned yesterday of the dangers of pettiness and factionalism, and today her red flag prompted a charge. An ad hoc committee of 14 women from Anchorage and the Koniag region requested that they be able to address the convention to read a resolution they had drafted the previous evening. The request was denied by statewide president Mary Jane Peterson, who stated that it was necessary to get on instead with the scheduled workshops. However, the parliamentarian, Ellen Hayes, ruled that the group's request was in order and motions were entertained from the floor. After a motion was made to allow the ad hoc group to speak, Georgiana Lincoln amended that motion to limit the presentation to 2 minutes. Said Lincoln, quote, Let's not do anything to divide ourselves. We have problems to work out, but let's have unity and not air our dirty laundry. Following heated discussion, the amendment and then the motion failed to pass. The ad hoc committee, chaired by Deesa Jacobson of Anchorage, was instructed to give their report at 11:30 following the workshops. I had heard from another reporter present at the meeting that the board had decided to bar reporters and non-natives from the workshops, though no announcement had been made from the floor. So I sat in on the workshop on Alaska Native women artists, at least for a while. Sometime into the session, Mary Jane Peterson came by and told me to leave. The group protested, but she insisted that board action would prevail. So instead, the group decided that we would be a discussion group, not a workshop, and I remained. Peterson's action seemed strange, since reporters were not barred from general sessions, including the volatile one that morning. And when the general session reconvened at 11:40, the action got hot again as the ad hoc committee presented their resolution. The resolution centered around a perceived inadequacy with the bylaws that, as drafted, they did not reflect the issues the Native Women's Group was formed to address, and a frustration at a lack of formal procedures and leadership at the convention. It was true that the president had not ever formally called the meeting to order, established a quorum, read the previous minutes, adopted the agenda, or established whether or not Robert's Rules of Order were in effect. But the discussion did not address those concerns, but rather the right of the ad hoc group to dissent at all, to air their frustrations. Members were asked to stand, identify themselves, and state whether they had attended last year's convention. The group was accused of being disruptive. Said Georgiana Lincoln, quote, We are united, we are a team, and we're going down that path together, regardless of our feelings when we're in this room. No one spoke to the issues brought forth by the ad hoc committee. At the conclusion of the half hour allotted to them, a more dramatic event occurred. The Koniag delegation withdrew from the statewide organization.
The decision made by the delegates of the Koniag region was not to continue our regional representation on the board of directors of the Alaska Native Women's Statewide Organization. Certain individuals from our region will be with drawing their names from the membership roll, including myself. In departing, we wish the delegation here at this convention and future conventions the very best in your goals and objectives. Thank you.
With that, the bulk of the delegation and most members of the ad hoc committee walked out. For the Koniaks, it was a $12,000 walkout, the price for sending the 12 delegates to Fairbanks. After that, I spoke with Deesa Johnson of the ad hoc committee.
Talk about Peter Principle, it was disorganized. Leadership qualities were lacking, and I came here with high hopes. I was turned on at last. The formal Native Women's Organization was organized, and during the bylaw meetings, it was shot down. I came away from there disillusioned. I'm sorry I ever came here, and I'm not coming back.
Tomorrow, the third and final day of the convention, it will be seen how many of the 100-plus women in attendance do come back. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.